Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. Parkinson's disease is often framed as a dopamine problem and clinically as a movement disorder. But what if the core unit of dysfunction is not just a neurotransmitter or a single place within the brain? What if it is a brain-wide action network that integrates movement with arousal, autonomic physiology, and motivation? I am Michele Matarazzo, the editor of the podcast, and today we will discuss a Nature paper proposing exactly that. The article is titled Parkinson's Disease as a Somatocognitive Action Network Disorder. Our guest is Professor Hesheng Liu from the Changping Laboratory in Beijing, China, the last and corresponding author of the paper. Hesheng, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for the introduction.
Okay, so I would like to start with the concept itself because it sounds elegant, but it can also sound a bit abstract. Many of us first learned the neuroanatomy through the classic Penfield homunculus, and until recent, that was the mainstay. But recently, a work published in Nature in 2023, I believe, this challenged the traditional somatotopic view of the motor cortex and introduced the concept of the somatocognitive action network, or SCAN. Can you explain us what SCAN is and why might it be relevant for Parkinson's disease?
Yeah, SCAN is a newly discovered network that sits in between the effector motor regions. So in the past, when Dr. Penfield identified the homunculus using cortical stimulation, of course, when they stimulate the effector area, they will see the response of the arms, the legs, or the tongue. But there are regions sitting in between those effector regions. But if you stimulate those regions, you don't see any obvious movement of the effectors. So it was missed 80 years ago when Dr. Penfield stimulated the cortex. But using the advanced neuroimaging technology, now you can clearly see there are some isolated regions sitting there in the motor region. So in the 2023 Nature paper, when Gordon et al. Identified those regions, they proposed that these regions are related to the cognitive function, not just the motor function. So they gave the name as the somatocognitive action network. I think it's a very elegant finding.
And just for everybody to understand this, the current understanding is that this area integrates what happens from a motor and a cognitive standpoint, right?
Yeah, I think that's partially correct. It probably transmit some cognitive information to the motor circuit, so the conventional motor circuit, or it has even more related functions, for example, to autonomic function, as well as some, for example, the low blood pressure, as you will observe in the Parkinson's patients, and the digestive problems and sleep problems. So they are probably all related to this SCAN network.
So now, before getting into the paper itself and to your study, why did you think that this specific network was relevant to Parkinson's?
They're good questions. Back in 2016, we have been trying to identify the functional circuits responsible for Parkinson's, which has been the dream of a lot of researchers. Of course, we want to know for this important functional disorder, what circuit is damaged or affected by the disease. So we have been using functional imaging technology, trying to see these functional circuits. But to be honest, we didn't see anything new until we saw this 2023 Nature paper. Then it gave us a lot of inspiration because we have known that Parkinson's is not a very simple movement disorder, even though it's always named or defined as a movement disorder. But you know that if there's a fire or it's an earthquake, the patients can immediately get their movement function back. They can run away from the scene. The cognitive input has a lot to do with their movement functions. So that's why I thought that Parkinson's probably it's a broader question about the cognitive function and the motor function. And when we saw the SCAN paper in 2023, that immediately resonate with a lot of questions. So now everything started to make sense. We immediately realized that this spot might be a broken hub in the Parkinson's patient's brain, which disrupted the connection between the cognitive area and the motor area. So then we started with this hypothesis and then studied those patients, and then we saw, that's exactly true.
Great. And I want to make maybe the last question before we get deeper into the paper. Is that, do you think functional imaging is, or specifically fMRI, is the best way of studying that? Or how does it compare with metabolic imaging? Let's say, for example, a FDG PET.
Mm-hmm. So there are actually different ways to study brain networks or the dysfunctioned areas of the patient's brain. Functional MRI has a lot of advantages over FDG PET in terms of the spatial resolution. And there are other approaches, for example, electrophysiology, to study the neural circuits. In the past, people have been recording a neurophysiology signal during the DBS stimulation. So that's another way to infer the connectivity between brain areas. However, I still believe functional MRI has the advantage of giving you a whole picture of the entire brain. And now, especially with MRI-compatible DBS, you can even study how the brain circuits respond to stimulation.
Perfect. Thank you for this very nice introduction and overview of the original problem. Now let's get to the paper. The paper is quite dense, in part also because it's a substantial translational effort. And you assembled a very large multimodal, multi-interventional data set with, I believe it's 863 participants across several cohorts, which is an amazing number. Now, before we get to the interventions, what were the first key findings when you examined the resting state functional connectivity in Parkinson's disease compared with healthy controls, and also in general when you analyzed it? What happens looking at this scan specifically?
So the key finding is the important subcortical structures that we know are related to Parkinson's. For example, the STN, GPI, and the substantia nigra, these nuclei, we all know that these structures are important for Parkinson's. And we want to know how these nuclei connect to the cortical areas. When we look at the resting state fMRI, we saw that all these structures show a very strong abnormal connectivity to the scan area in the cortex. Compared to the healthy subjects, Parkinson's showed an abnormal hyperconnectivity. That means overly connected. So that's the very surprising observation.
So basically, you're suggesting that all these therapeutic targets that we've been using for years, the STN, the GPI, the thalamus, and so on, they were modulating this scan all along. We just didn't know it, right?
Yes. In the past, we probably assume that these cortical structures are connected to the motor region. So we took for granted that these regions are part of the motor circuits. We assume they are connected to the M1, but we never systematically explore where these subcortical structures connectivity project to. We guess that maybe project to the hand area, foot area, or tongue area, but it turns out none of them is true. It all project to the scan area.
Now, if I may ask, maybe there might be some of our listeners that are not expert in neuroimaging or neurophysiology. Can you clarify what you mean by hyperconnectivity?
That means that the signal between the cortical scan area and the signal in those cortical structures, they are super correlated. Their correlation is very high, which is abnormal because they should be more independent. But something happened that caused some super synchronization between these deep nuclei and the cortical area.
Perfect. Now, another important thing that you mentioned in the paper is that there are many disorders that involve both motor and cognitive changes. Now, you addressed this directly by including other neurological cohorts and conditions such as essential tremor and odor conditions. What did these comparisons show?
We had a question whether the hyperconnectivity between scan and these subcortical structures is a common feature for all movement disorders, for example, dystonia, essential tremor, and ALS. With these questions in mind, we study these patients' group and compare them with the healthy participants. Surprisingly, the hyperconnectivity we observed in the Parkinson patients was not observed in ALS patients, not in the essential tremor patients, not in the dystonia patients. So that suggests that this hyperconnectivity may have some specificity for Parkinson's. But I'm not saying that only Parkinson's can bring this hyperconnectivity, but at least among these several movement disorders we studied, Parkinson's is the only disorder that showed this very strong hyperconnectivity.
And would you expect to find the same hyperconnectivity with other types of Parkinsonism?
That's a good question. We are actively exploring with other subtypes of Parkinson's syndrome, MSA or PSP. So that's an ongoing project.
Okay, I look forward to the results. Now let's move to the treatment effects. You did not stop to at defining an imaging phenotype. That you examined how it changes with therapy. Across levodopa and multiple neuromodulation approaches, the central message is that effective treatments reduce the scan to subcortex hyperconnectivity. What were the key interventions you studied, and what gave you confidence that this pattern is robust rather than a one-off finding?
Yeah, I think that all these treatments converge onto this hyperconnectivity, which is remarkable. We first studied DBS because we collected a huge amount of data from 14 patients who underwent DBS treatment. We scanned them for many hours in an MRI. For example, for each patient, before the DBS implantation, we collected the baseline data for 1 day. And then after the implantation, we scanned the patient for 2 days continuously. Of course, only during the daytime. When the patients are feeling comfortable, we will put a patient in a scanner and then stimulate them using different parameters. For example, sometimes we stimulate them with 60 hertz stimulation, sometimes 90 hertz, sometimes 130 hertz. Sometimes we turn it on and turn it off. Sometimes we stimulate them continuously. For each patient, we schedule them for a two-day scanning session. And we repeat this 5 times in 1 year. So that means we scan each patient for about 10 days after implantation. So we know exactly how DBS modulates the functional activity in each patient's brain. And we saw almost the identical or highly similar phenomena across all individuals. So that's why we have so much confidence that when we stimulate the STM, we saw the reduction of this connectivity between scan and STM. So that's the key information that a very well accepted treatment, it looks like it took effect by reducing this connectivity. And later, we also try to see if the medication, which is the most common treatment for all the patients, we saw the same thing. It still reduced the hyperconnectivity.
That's very interesting. And another thing to discuss is the importance of the beta band, which is a known physiological marker for Parkinson's organism. How does it relate to this hyperconnectivity?
That's a very good question. We have recorded EEG signal from the DBS electrodes. So we know that when we stimulate the brain, that the beta band activity changes. And there are some previous studies showing a hypersynchronization between the cortex and the subcortical regions in the beta band. We believe that this desynchronization of the beta band is probably related to the reduced connectivity we saw in fMRI. But we need more direct evidence.
Okay. Now, you gave even a step further. So we discussed already the study of this hyperconnectivity as a biomarker, then how it changes with the treatment. But you went a step further doing TMS trials. So you randomized 36 patients with Parkinson's to intermittent theta burst stimulation over a personalized scan target or over the effector-specific motor target. And apparently, targeting scan appeared to produce a substantially greater motor benefit. Can you walk us through what you stimulated and how the target was individualized and what changed from the clinical standpoint?
Yeah, so we studied 36 patients. We randomized them into two groups. So one group, we run a functional MRI scan and then we using a network parcellation approach. So we have been developing functional network parcellation algorithms in the past decade. So now we have a sophisticated way to map out those regions. So for each patient, we can identify their scan area and the effector area. So for the scan treatment group, we will use TMS to stimulate the middle piece of the scan. So if you look at the 2023 Nature paper, the original scan paper, there are three spots in the presental gyrus. So the top one is oftentimes sitting in the sulci. So it's not very easily accessible using TMS. But the middle one is relatively easy to be accessed by a TMS. So we chose that one. And for the control group, we stimulate the effector area either on top of this middle scan spot or below the scan spot. So the distance between the M1 target and the scan target is probably about 1 centimeter, but the effect is drastically different. The efficacy is about 2.5 times better when you stimulate scan compared to stimulating the effector M1. That tells us even in the motor area, the TMS treatment should consider precise targeting. If you can identify the correct scan target, you get a lot of benefit. But if you are missed by 1 centimeter, you're off, and then you are stimulating the effector motor region, the efficacy is much lower.
And of course, you also state clearly that this was a relatively small single center study. But just to make sure that the audience know, this was a blinded trial, right?
Yes. So the patients and the staff, they did not know which patient is receiving the scan treatment, which one is receiving the M1 treatment.
Now, if you were designing the next trial with this, what would you prioritize? Patient selection outcomes, such as gait or freezing or longer follow-up? What would you study?
So right now, I have several follow-up studies going on. One study is exactly like you described, that we want to focus on gait and freezing. These symptoms are very hard to treat compared to tremor. So these symptoms cannot be controlled by medication in a lot of patients. DBS cannot control it. But in our patients, we even with the small sample, we saw that we have very good effect on this gait problem. So now we want to select some patients with particular problems in the gait and freezing. So that's one study. And the other one is that we wanted to focus on some non-motor symptoms, for example, the sleep problems and the digestion and the low blood pressure. So we want to see how scan treatment can improve those symptoms.
So you're trying also to target symptoms that are very difficult to manage often with the options that we currently have.
I think there's a very strong need for this. And of course, we want to do a multi-center study to corroborate our findings.
Perfect. Now for the focus ultrasound community, and myself for one, we do a lot of focus ultrasound. I know you also examined VIM thalamotomy, and you introduced a very practical concept. How close the lesion is to the patient-specific thalamic representation of scan. Now, you studied a cohort of 10 patients.
Yes.
Can you tell me what happened there?
This is a very early study of the MRI-guided focus ultrasound lesion study. So we lesioned the VIM, this thalamic area, in these tremor-dominant patients. And we saw some improvements in some patients, and some patients are not responding very well. So after almost 3 years, now we have a strong hypothesis that this scan circuit is the core circuit for Parkinson's. We look at the original lesion targets, see if there's anything we can find. And we observe that if you lesion the area that's connected to the cortical scan, then you see a very strong response in those patients. But if you're more off, then the efficacy is worse. So it looks like it's a strong correlation between the distance to the scan sweet spot and the behavioral response. So our guess is that in the future, maybe we could do a functional MRI scan for the patients before the focused ultrasound lesion, and then identify the sweet spot in the thalamus, and then we lesion that area. That may improve the efficacy.
So the broader implication is that we may actually gradually move from purely anatomical coordinates towards circuit-defined targets in a personalized manner, still within the thalamus, but guided by the single patient functional connectome, right?
Yes. So that's the idea. Because thalamus is a big structure. Now, if you do the lesion in a conventional way, you are doing it in a trial and error fashion. But now if you can use the functional circuit to guide you, that you may see a better outcome.
Perfect. Now, let me get to a couple of important questions, maybe more challenging questions. First of all, do you think hyperconnectivity is a cause, a compensatory response, or a downstream marker of other pathophysiological changes that are happening in Parkinson's? And what type of evidence would falsify or support the idea of scan as a core mechanism rather than just a marker?
So my take of this is a cause instead of a compensatory mechanism. The reason is that if it is a compensatory mechanism, then the patient gets higher connectivity, he could have an improved motor function. So that's what compensation means. But we don't see those. Actually, we saw that if you treat the patients with DBS or other treatments, the improvement of the behavioral function is correlated with the reduction of the hyperconnectivity. They go in the same direction, so instead of the opposite, right? So that's why I think it's more likely a cause.
And may I add another question on that? If this hyperconnectivity is the cause of what happens in Parkinson's disease and of the disease itself, maybe, don't you think that all this treatment that modify and reduce this hyperconnectivity, don't you think they should have a disease-modifying effect on the disease?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think that we all believe that dopamine neuron loss is the cause of the accumulation of this alpha-synuclein. So I believe that these microscopic changes in the brain that will lead to the macroscopic changes of the functional circuit. However, reducing the connectivity itself, whether this means a disease-modifying process or not, I think it's not directly proving that reducing the connectivity is modifying disease. It's probably controlling the symptoms. However, stimulating the scan, I personally believe it's modifying the disease process. I have some evidence for that, not in this paper, but I have several things I want to mention. So that my first patient that I treated several years ago, we treated this patient repeatedly. Every 6 months, we treat her for 2 weeks, and we saw that the disease process is modified. The patient, her Parkinson's facial expression is gone, and her medication is reduced by 60 to 70%, which is very unusual. Usually, after several years, you see the patients are taking more and more medication rather than less and less. And the patient's motor function is dramatically improved. So when I first treated her several years ago, she couldn't walk independently, but now she's dancing almost every day in her dancing class, and she even could travel to Europe. So you can see that it's reversed. And then we also performed some animal studies. We saw this effect very clear in our mouse model. If you stimulate scan, then you see that even after you stop the stimulation, the animal's behavioral function continues to improve. That means you don't need to do continuous stimulation like DBS, and you can still see the improvement of the motor function. But DBS, when you stimulate these subcortical structures, you don't see much disease-modifying effect. So even after several years of DBS treatment, if you turn off the stimulator, the symptoms come back almost immediately, right? So it's a very different effect we observed in the cortex stimulation and the subcortical stimulation.
This is very fascinating. Of course, we will love to see more data of this, and all of these ideas are very fascinating. Let's see what data you will show us in the future. I will get to maybe one of the last questions, which is, you already told me that you are planning and you're doing already other studies specifically looking at different manifestations of Parkinson's. But if you had to guess, which symptom domains do you expect to be most tightly linked to scan?
I think it's probably the gait and the autonomic functions. So that also goes very well with the original proposal of the function of scan in the 2023 paper. Gordon et al. Proposed that this network is probably modulating the autonomic functions. And so I believe that's the right direction to go.
Now, the last question. If a movement disorders clinician takes one message from this paper, what should it be?
So Parkinson's, in the past, it was defined based on the symptoms. It's a movement disorder. But now we know the functional underpinning of this disease. So now the definition has been advanced to a scan disorders because we know exactly what functional circuit is broken in this disease.
Perfect. And I think it's a very timely message because we're discussing a lot lately about switching Parkinson's disease from a clinical definition to a biological definition. And then putting a network definition in the game here makes it all much more complex, but also interesting.
Yeah.
Now, Hesching, thank you very much. This paper offers a genuine conceptual reframe of Parkinson's, not simply as a set of symptoms, but as you were mentioning, as a network level disorder of action with scan hyperconnectivity as a unifying signature and a potential target that could make both invasive and non-invasive neuromodulation more precise. Thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.